I'm Kenny Pasenik Linden with Radio Free Palmer, and joining me from Washington, D.C. is Senator Mark Begich. And thank you, Senator, for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
So we have a few questions for you today. We have four general questions, but our theme overarching these questions is how do you work with others? So a bit of background, both nationally and here in Alaska, there seems to have developed a more than usual political polarization, resulting in gridlock and decisions made by use of power that isn't always backed by a majority of citizens. So with that in mind, how do you view the present state of government, and how do you work with others of different perspectives, both within and without your party?
Well, I think generally on the federal government, actually I would say on even the state government, but definitely the federal government where I am working in now, that there is kind of some dysfunctional ability to get along and get things done. But, you know, what I have found, I've adapted to the situation. It's different than I think most of us would like, where people are sitting down and working on issues and trying to resolve issues, at a conference table or at a committee meeting. But what I've tried to do, and I think I have a record within the U.S. Senate of working with almost all the Republicans in some form or another, sponsoring pieces of legislation, or like in the case of with Senator Murkowski, my colleague, this year we have voted 80% of the time together, more than any other what they call split delegation, where you have a Democrat and a Republican serve in the same state, than any other state in the Senate. And over the last 6 years since I've been in office, it's well over 60%. So, you know, that is, I think, a testament to working with her. Doesn't mean we always agree. There's issues we may disagree on, but at the same time, I try to find the common good and figure out how we can work it out rather than complaining all the time. And a lot of people around here like to complain, and then they wonder why they don't get things done. And my view is, let's just work on the issue, figure out where we find common ground, and then do our best to get things done. I was able, I'll throw out one item as an example, a pretty big piece of legislation about 2 years ago that I got passed, which was the Coast Guard Reauthorization Bill. I worked with my counterpart in the House, who's a Republican, my ranking member, who's a Republican, and the ranking Democrat in the House, and we worked out our differences and passed the Coast Guard Reauthorization Bill with no debate, unanimous support of the Senate and unanimous support of the House. I think people just need to get focused and quit having personality battles and quit arguing with each other and figure out where their common ground is.
Do you think when it comes to the role of filibusters used in the Senate at the moment, how does that, is it helpful or is it a hindrance at this point? Because with the Not My Boss's Business bill that just came up last week, we had a filibuster. So how is that working against that sense of community across the aisle?
Well, think about it. This is a bill that we were only a couple votes short of getting it to move forward. That was just a motion to proceed, meaning that that would just get us on the bill, and then we could debate the amendments if there were any. And what we have are people who refuse to have these debates. And I think that's very damaging to the process, very corrosive to the process. But at the same time, I think if we would just, again, put aside our partisan differences and focus on what we can get done and then work toward that, I think there's a much better result that we can all get. And I think the filibuster rule has actually helped us move a lot of pieces of legislation forward in the sense of appointments and judges and small bills. But you know, now what's happening is the other side, even when we have a 100-0 vote, 100-0, they still filibuster it to burn up time on the clock for no reason other than, I think, creating penance for those that changed the filibuster rule. And that's all it's about. It has nothing to do with getting, you know, successful results. It's just they want to penalize the people who change the rules, even though at the end of the day we're passing these, some of these appointments, 100-0. So it doesn't make any sense. And I think it's petty. It reminds me of, you know, middle school. And I think some of these guys need to grow up and move on and find the common ground. And that's what Alaskans are interested in. And that's what Americans are interested in.
Do you see a way of moving that forward? Do you see a way of being able to reach across the aisle and really moving past these partisan politics in the sense of the actual how it our policies are voted on just the actual, the way politics moves forward, not just the content?
I do, and I say that because I do believe once we get out of this election season, people will hopefully put on their sanity hats again and get back to working on issues. And I do think, you know, we're going to have a lot of new members this cycle because there'll be a lot of retirements that are occurring, both on the Democratic and Republican side. And that will by itself create a new dynamic, a new attitude of how to work together. And I do think that if we can get through that election, and again, there's going to be new people, then I believe that we will be able to start moving issues forward. I do believe that.
So speaking about some of those issues, here in Alaska, there's been considerable focus on balancing both resource development of extractive industries, such as mining, with environmental concerns. What are your guiding principles when weighing in on this topic?
Well, I think the important thing is, you know, I have supported mining in many ways down in the southeast with Kensington, Greens Creek, Bocan, Niblack Mines, or Red Dog, helping them get an additional permit, or Fort Knox, the Yucabeli Mines. But, for example, on the Pebble Mine, I believed, based on the science and thousands of Alaskans that contacted me and the dozens of meetings that I had with both sides on that issue, I came to the conclusion that that mine was the wrong mine, the wrong place. It would negatively impact our fisheries, and the net result is we would lose a renewable resource over time. I wasn't willing to make that trade-off. Now, that does not mean, and I know some people out there saying, well, if he didn't support that mine, he must not be supporting mine. So that's just not true. I look at each mine as they are presented. I look at the community impact, the science surrounding it, what people in the neighborhood or the community are talking about, what's the job impact, are they mines that actually will move forward, and then I analyze it from that perspective, and then I make a decision. And every mine that I've supported, you know, like I said, Bocan and Niblack and Kensington and Greens Creek and Red Dog and Fort Knox and Donlin and Yucabeli, I can go through the list, are ones that I've analyzed as they've come forward. And Pebble Mine, I just didn't see it going to be a long-term benefit to the area there in the sense of its environmental impact to our fisheries. And fisheries support 40 to 50,000 Alaskans, and we should be focused on supporting our industry that's renewable.
How do you think the role of the EPA comes into that? Because the EPA coming out specifically with the Pebble Mine coming out in kind of an offensive pre-permits and pre-licenses coming forward for the Pebble Mine and coming out essentially stating how protecting the fisheries in Bristol Bay is more important at this point. And how do you think the EPA within Alaska and the Department of Natural Resources, how do you think they work together here in the state to balance that, both industry and jobs, as well as protecting the environment?
Well, as in this situation, it was clear that the community did not believe the state was representing their viewpoints. And because of that, they then requested the EPA to come in and do this scientific analysis, which the community has that right to do that. So they had a recourse here because they felt the state was kind of ramrodding something through, and they weren't, or they believe they weren't being heard. So this was the only recourse that the community had. Now, saying that, keep in mind what EPA laid out was, if you do this mine in this specific area on this specific ore, meaning not what people feared, which was some blanket view statewide, it wasn't. It was very, very narrow cast in where they wanted to make the decision. And what they said is, here are the parameters you must achieve if you decide to do a mine of this magnitude, and they had a description of the size of the mine. This is something that is very unusual in the sense that usually mines go and pull their permits, they work through the process, and they get EPA coming in. EPA then says, oh, here's some things you need to do. Then the mine complains that we didn't know that EPA wanted us to do that. Well, here's the first time that EPA is saying, before you pull your permit, here's some things you should be aware of, and that being aware of them would be helpful. So then as you develop your permitting, you know what to address. And if you're unable to address it, then you know what the risk of permitting it will be. In a lot of ways, this was a way to describe to the mind the concerns that could come up in the future. That would give the mind the opportunity before they pull their permit to address those issues in their plan. So it doesn't stop the mind from moving forward. It just tells them, here's the parameters on this very, very narrow focus specific location and ore deposit.
How do you think that comes into potential development in Anwar?
I don't think it has any impact. I think there's a lot of people who believe that somehow the EPA was going to have some large, over-expansive decision. They did not. Very, very narrow focus. I don't think it has any impact and will not have any impact. And so I'm not worried about that. And on the second piece is if there was ever some move by EPA in regards to Anwar prior to any development, because there's been no plan of development at this point for Anwar other than us that advocate for it, that would be uncalled for, and we would do whatever we can to prevent that. But it's not having an impact to Anwar.
Okay. All right. And we'll go ahead and move on. Edward J. Snowden's actions this last year have led to a widespread discussion about another balance, this one being between privacy and security. The often overlooked aspect of the Snowden affair is the role of media in reporting about or deferring to government activities. What are your guiding principles when weighing in on this topic?
You mean regarding Snowden or media?
More the privacy and security aspect.
Oh,
media as well, but privacy and security. You bet.
I think the NSA has overreached, and I think I didn't support the Patriot Act. I didn't support the reauthorization of FISA. I think they're intrusive. I think they've gone too far. These courts, these cigarette courts, have done some things that the public obviously is unaware of, and we're finding out day by day how much information the NSA is gathering from all of us, and who knows, they might be listening to us right now. I think they've gone too far. I've supported legislation to curb them back, to have more transparency, not risking national security, but making sure that the civil liberties of all of us are not jeopardized or at risk by these federal agencies that are not accountable in a public manner. So I've been very strong in making it clear that I think they've overstepped their bounds.
Do you have any ideas of how to reconcile that, to be able to make sure that private civil liberties are protected?
Well, first off, for example, when the courts make a determination, these secret courts, that what they should do is be able to let people know the process that took place. You don't have to know the name of the individual, the details, but letting the public understand this process more in a transparent way, I think would be very helpful. Second, I think the NSA cannot have this overreaching survey capacity that they have with electronic information, and I think that is very important. And even the courts recently, even though it may not play well with public safety, there have been some issues where they've curtailed the rights of public safety officers just to take information off of your Palm Pilot or your cell phone or your smartphone or your computer. So there's a lot of things that can be done, but transparency is a big part of it without risking our national security, and I think there's a way to do that.
Is there legislation that you think that could come in that
yes.
would be able to support that?
I already am on legislation that Senator Wyden from Oregon has sponsored to go after these specific issues. I've been a co-sponsor on his legislation, and we're just pending, waiting for action by the Senate on the floor. So I've already been supportive, and as well as saying no to FISA, no to the Patriot Act. They've gone too far, and I think they've extended beyond their need in many areas of spying on the American citizens.
Do you think part of the media role in our 24-hour news environment, do you think part of that maybe is also part of the problem when it comes to our partisan politics as well, that it's almost as if politicians are being overly careful about what they say in public, what could be recorded, what could be shared on social media and YouTube or even on C-SPAN and the rest of our news outlets. Do you think that this media environment, as well as the privacy and security part of it, is part of what is feeding into partisan politics?
Well, I think it's, if I can make it state in a different way, and that is, I think what the problem is, we got a news by the minute. You can have within an hour three different stories from the same topic that are completely different, because I think the media is hungry to just get the new story, the new edge, the new, you know, headline, the new story that can get them, national recognition. I think that's a problem. There's not as much in-depth review or consistent review. For example, you know, have you read really recently anything about the plane crash down by Australia from Malaysia there? No, it's already off the news. Yet, you know, several hundred people lost their lives and we haven't heard a word on it because now there's a new story or a new issue. And I think in a lot of ways the media has not done, in my personal view, enough in regards to being consistent in bringing the stories to the forefront on a regular basis. They might do it for one day, then that's it. Well, Alaskans are very busy. They have lots of things on their mind, and if you do any research on how people have taken information, if you're not frequently reminding people of the information, they don't pay attention to it. And I think the media is just too hungry every day to have the new gotcha or the new gimmick or the new story that may be totally irrelevant to what's on the headline. And I think that's part of it. The other thing is, honestly, you know, I try not to watch too much TV because I've been very busy and I spend a lot of time reading material and other things I get through my job. But yet, you know, there's a reality show on everything. I mean, you know, if you
especially,
you
know, in Alaska, it seems like
Alaska.
We're the
everything.
New favorite.
I mean, every time I turn around, there's some new reality show, and then there's some, you know, the ones that are non-Alaskan. That there's some that are just don't make any sense, and I think that is problematic because you're not getting kind of the information through your news media. And then, of course, you know, it's like with that commercial, that insurance commercial, when this person was dating someone or on the website and said the guy speaks French and is from France, and of course he really wasn't, on the internet, that people believe 100% of what they hear and read on the internet, and I think that's also very dangerous. So I think there's not a filter that maybe is as needed, is more needed now than ever before on what news that people are getting or information. There's kind of I saw it on such and such station, so I must believe it. And I think people should spend more time doing their own research, and that's very hard in this very busy time we all lead.
Thank you. And as part of that, I suspect you, maybe not so much in D.C., because people are hopefully a little bit more familiar with Alaska, that you don't get the "do you live in an igloo" and mush
right.
dogs to work sort of questions. But even with some of the reality shows, we seem to have a lot of that now with Alaska State Troopers and things that I know people in other countries that watch as well. So going ahead and moving on to our last general question, the Supreme Court has recently taken stands that seem to put corporations above individuals. In Alaska, that may be one aspect of the discussion of the role of oil companies and what their role and how they play in our owner state. How do you view corporations?
Well, Supreme Court has gone overboard here. You know, first they said corporations are people, and therefore...
And are you referring to the Citizens United case there?
Citizens United. In other words, they have determined that people, through the Citizens United case, which I call Citizens Divided because that's what it's doing, that they have determined that corporations are people. If they're people, imagine what's next on the list. Well, we found it. It was the next week. Several weeks later, as we saw just recently, the Hobby Lobby ruling. They've now said that your boss, your corporation, can determine what your insurance company will offer or not when it comes to birth control. And what's next? Because they have a religious view. The corporation has a religious view. Corporations don't have religious views. People have religious views. They actually took a portion of the law that's been in law for many years on religious freedoms that was designed to protect employees from employers imposing their religious views on you. So they turned that around, turned it up on its head, said, no, corporations now have religious views. They do not. They are not people. They are a product of paper and lawyers. That's all they are. And so it's really... The Supreme Court has gone overboard. And, you know, if you're not careful, the way it will come out next is you could be, for example, have a job and your employer doesn't believe in vaccines, so your kids who aren't even employed at the job no longer can get vaccines through their insurance program. So what they're basically doing is putting an undue hardship, economic hardship, on middle-class families and individuals because they have a, they believe the corporation now has this religious view, which is unbelievable. I think the founders of our country, our Constitution, would be turning over in their graves if this is, I mean, if this doesn't make any sense.
Would you be, with the argument of people talking about partisan politics reaching the Supreme Court and the idea of activist judges, how would you respond to that when it comes to even just looking at the division on the Supreme Court and the Hobby Lobby case, that all three female Supreme Court judges were voted in dissent on the Hobby Lobby case? They didn't agree with what the five all-male judges had decided.
Right.
So when it comes to this idea of appointing judges and activist judges and the politics of courts, how would you approach that subject?
Well, when you look at that decision, as you said, five men, three women, and one man voted no against the Hobby Lobby issue because they knew that was wrong and it was turning the current law upside down. Now, I don't view that, you know, you got to be careful on judges, and, you know, you want to make sure they are thoughtful, they focus on the law, they determine the law, but they're not activists and trying to rewrite the laws on the books. And I think some of these guys are rewriting the laws. I mean, again, corporations are not people. And if that's the case and they're people, between my wife and me, we have three different corporations. So I should get three additional votes in the next election because obviously they're people. I think I might register them. I might go down to elections office and say, hey, they're people. I want to register my corporation to vote for my interests as well as me. That doesn't make any sense.
Which ties into the idea that money equals free speech as well. And
right. I mean,
coming back to that piece specifically here in Alaska when it comes to Proposition 1 coming up and Senate Bill 21 and the role of oil companies here in Alaska and corporate oil tax, how would you approach that subject as very much an Alaskan issue?
It's very much an Alaskan issue, and I would say this on two fronts. One, there is no question in my mind, and I think most Alaskans, that you have to have some stability in the tax structure in order to increase investment in any area, maybe oil and gas, mining, timber, whatever the business might be. Stability and certainty in oil or tax policy is important. But saying that, SB 21, which is attempting to create, to leave certainty, but yet the effort to repeal it is because of a concern that there are not conditions that determine if this they get this oil tax break, what are they going to give us in exchange? The problem with this law either way is I think no matter what, it's going to end up back in the legislative session come January because one side doesn't trust the other, another side doesn't trust. I mean, they don't trust each other. So what happens in the legislative session this last year, they all hunkered into their corners and decided not to sit down and try to resolve this like all Alaskans do on every issue. And I think this is the symptom of a bigger problem of direct partisan politics, people not sitting down for the common good. And now we have a battle royale, you might say, this August between, you know, 50,000 people who signed an initiative to get that on the ballot and oil companies spending millions of dollars to protect their benefit and citizens who believe the benefit has gone too far. The problem is, either vote occurs, I think we're going to be back in the session come January trying to resolve this issue. And I think it's more important that people commit that come January, when the legislative session starts in Juneau, that people are going to sit down, recognize we must have certainty with our tax policy, and also protecting the resource of Alaska. And I think you can get there. But I think this is a very divisive issue, as you can see by the polling data. It's split right down the middle, despite the fact I think the oil companies have spent $7, maybe $8 million to date, and yet no outcome has occurred that can show a dramatic yes or dramatic no on this.
Yeah, thank you very much. That it's being here in Alaska, and I know you've been in and out of the state, that it's something that you see bumper stickers and you see placards
everything.
And yards, and so it's something that we're seeing a lot of I would like to thank you for joining us today. This has been a great and very insightful interview, I think. And thank you for taking the time out. And I know DC is a very busy place, and we really appreciate being able to hear you on our Local Valley Radio.
Well, thank you, guys. Thanks for doing a great show. Thank you for having a radio station in the Valley. I think that, especially your station, it's great, and it gives a lot of new variety in the Valley. So thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much, Senator.